Lumpur Sumedho sends his greetings from Thailand to everybody in the Amaravati community. He sent a brief message saying that he was going to be going into personal retreat for the rest of the rains retreat, so he won't even be going out on alms round. Just one of the monks will bring his alms food to his kuti, so he's going even further into seclusion and delighting in solitude. He also mentioned that, in passing, that he was noticing how he's become completely identified with being British, since when he hears news of the British getting another gold medal, he feels happy, delighted, and when he hears an American getting a gold medal, he feels nothing. And it was, interestingly enough, it was also just this evening I realized, oh, I'm American too, I forgot that. I have an American passport as well as a British one. And oh yes, I had completely forgotten to feel any interest or excitement when an American got a gold medal too. As everyone is aware, I'm sure, that the country is in the grip of Olympic fever. And outside of Amaravati, particularly in London, the place is covered in flags, and there's a great excitement, interest, enthusiasm, and massive amounts of patriotic fervor, as they say. It's interesting, useful, to reflect on the nature of competition. You know, this is a grand global event. They say, at least in some of the reports, the opening ceremonies were watched by a huge proportion of Earth's population, something like 2 billion people, a third of the world's population, busy watching this event. So this is something that gathers a lot of human energy to it, a lot of attention, and it's therefore something worthy of consideration. You know, why do we find competition so exciting? What's its value? How does it sit in the world? How does it sit in our lives? Why does it gather so much attention, so much energy, so much interest to it? Yeah. Well, it doesn't take a lot of investigation to realize that competition is exciting. When the two things are competing against each other, it's exciting. Conflict is exciting. As Lumpur Sumedho would often say, they'd never put on the headlines of the newspaper, Ajahn Sumedho had a mindful inhalation. That would never be a banner headline on the front of the Sun or the Daily Mail or even the Guardian. It's not news. Peace is not exciting. Peace is not interesting. The in-breath and the out-breath are not newsworthy. But conflict and competition, you know, violence and so forth, these are exciting. They catch our interest. They go straight to the reptile brain. They cause a flush of adrenaline, excitement in the system. And different people are obviously excited by different things, different kinds of competition, different kinds of tension and such like. But this is a natural instinct and a common and simple reaction for all of us, that from early childhood and our conditioning as human beings, living in a human group, living in a family, competing with your siblings, so growing up and going to school and competing with the other children in the class for academic achievement, competing on the sports field, competing for how you look, competing for who's the tallest or who's the strongest or who's the prettiest, the instinctual habits that we have as human beings, living as part of the human family, causes us to compare ourselves with each other and to get a sense of relish and excitement, interest of being, a sense of identity comes from that comparing and competing. This is why it's exciting, because it feeds the habit of identification, it feeds our sense of existence, of being. Yeah. So right now, people in this country are probably, or those who are British, are probably feeling far more consciously British than usual, because the competition, and then the UK team competing against others, and winning and losing, getting gold medals in some things, coming out on top in the women's boxing, or the dressage horse trials, getting completely thrashed by the Dutch at hockey. Where's Narendra? Yes. the team GB completely caned, 9-2 by the Dutch. Completely ignominious defeat. These things make the news, don't they? The great victory, hooray, we won. Terrible defeat, oh my God. 9-2, 9-2, what an embarrassment. And by the Dutch as well. So to me, when I'm reflecting on this, not that I've been paying a huge amount of attention to it, but just reflecting on those comments of Lumpur and considering this, in a way, I feel it's extremely skillful to have these kind of national competitions and to set things up in this way, as they did in the times of ancient Greece. You'd have all the different local nations in the Greek peninsula, the Athenians and the Spartans and the Macedonians and so forth, all competing against each other, and having foot races or throwing javelins and discuses and such like. Because in that way, by having a ritualized combat, a formalized combat, then you have all the thrill of warfare, you have all the thrill of the combat, the joy of victory, and the excitement of the contest, and the thrill of the crowd, but you don't have a pile of dead bodies at the end, or smashed limbs and torn out guts and ruined families. The injuries are fairly minor, so that this kind of formalized or ritualized combat, in a way, it's dealing with the human aggressive and competitive urges and sort of channeling them in skillful ways, so that different groups can follow those instinctual urges for comparing and competing, but with minimal damage along the way. That you are transforming those sort of tribal tendencies to be fighting and causing bloodshed and death, murder amongst your own people and the neighboring tribes, and you're taking those energies. Those customs that would have ended up with a great deal of pain and destruction and misery, and guiding them in a skillful way. So in this respect, I feel it's a skillful direction, a skillful directing of the human family's competitive and violent urges, and also the urge for identity, along with the kind of skillful side of it, say it's helping us not to be just laying into each other and bludgeoning each other to death, hacking each other to pieces. There's also that quality of feeling a sense of patriotism or fondness for your own group, and that can be a skillful and beautiful thing, that a sense of belonging and a sense of family, a sense of commitment and a connection to others. But of course, there's a shadow side of that, whereby, as we can see, that when you look at the realm of sports and competition and nationalism generally, that this can be also a huge identification feast, a sort of Bhava Tanha fest, a kind of grand orgy of becoming totally identified with your nationality and your team. You know, people painting their faces and their bodies with national flags, and dressing in clothes, you know, and completely going berserk, identifying with their own nation. And so then, when there is a success and a delight, then they're totally blissfully happy. And when they are in a losing situation, the team has lost, the competitor has been knocked out, then floods of tears and misery. So even you know, when we look at this area, you might think, well, sports has got nothing to do with Dhamma practice, or this is totally tangential to say what we're doing here at Amaravati. You know, here we are, it's community retreat time. You know, this is got nothing to do with us, really. This is all extraneous and insignificant, unimportant. But we belong to the human family. We're a part of the same human group. We experience the same instincts and urges and attractions and aversions as the rest of the human family. So I feel these aspects of of the external world do have their own counterparts here inside the monastery. It's also interesting and useful to reflect that. When we see how much that competitive ethic is a process built around becoming, trying to become, trying to be the best, trying to be the winner, and in the athletes nowadays, it's not no longer anything remotely like an amateur effort. That when people have huge amounts of their time, huge proportions of their lives, years and years and hours a day dedicated to developing their own particular skill, their sport. It's a colossal investment of human time and energy and attention. So there's an enormous amount of becoming that's involved in that. And so even as we know, the Bhava Tanha is one of the causes of suffering, the desire to become, the desire to be, the desire to exist, the desire to be identified with a particular quality. Even if you get what you want, even if you become the champion, even if you succeed, the degree to which that is built upon Bhava Tanha, the desire to become, the desire to identify, is directly proportional to the amount of suffering that will come from that, because, you know, then you have the thrill of achievement, the delight of conquest, you know, the incredible flush of joy as you win, as you conquer the opponent, and you get to the top. But then it doesn't take long before you realize what comes with it, yeah? and forever after, your life is going to be a disappointment, or it's never going to quite reach that wonderful height, or you're going to be in a position where suddenly you're the target. I remember years ago, Kitisaro, he and I were monks together in the early days in Thailand, and before he joined the monastery, he'd been a wrestler, not a sort of professional. sort of all in wrestling type, but sort of Greco-Roman wrestling, you know, the sort of Olympic type wrestling. And he was extremely successful. So he grew up in Tennessee, Chattanooga, and he became the Eastern States champion twice over in his weight in the USA. So that's all the states east of the Mississippi. He was the champion. At his own particular weight as a high school and college student. So twice over, he was the Eastern States champion. He was never the national champion, but the champion of the whole eastern side of the USA. And he was saying how the first time that he won that competition, and he threw the other person and won the fight, and there was this phenomenal flush of delight, this incredible happiness. And he said it was so completely blissful. It was like he'd never been so happy in all his life. It was like this feeling of complete fulfillment and satisfaction. He said that lasted about 10 minutes between, you know, flooring the other guy and winning the bout, and then standing up on the podium and getting the medal. Because once he stood up on the podium, then there's the whole array of people that he'd just beaten in the run-up to this fight, and they're all looking at him and got this glint in their eyes saying, next year, you know. And so then there was this anxiety of, oh no, I've got to do it again. Oh dear, this precious thing, this wonderful achievement, this glorious identity is under threat, and now I've got to work like crazy to sustain it, to keep it, to make it happen again next year. So I don't know whether he reflected on it in that way at the time, but he said it was about 10 minutes of pure happiness and then months and months of anxiety having to, you know, repeat the performance. For myself, in a much smaller way, and when I was a student, I was quite gifted at hurdles. I inherited very flexible hips from my mother. Thank you, Mum. So even though I got quite short legs, I discovered that I was quite quick over the sprint hurdles, and so at the 80-meter hurdles under 13 age group, and then the 100-meter hurdles under 15 age group, I was the county champion for Kent, for the county of Kent here in England. And at that age, when you're like 12 years old, 13, 14 years old, that was serious currency in school life, you know, because only one or two other pupils in the school reached that sort of county standard and also ran for the county team. So when I first won that that championship, yeah, I was, you know, incredibly pleased with myself and thought, this is really great, this is really wonderful. And so then when you get to win the county championship and you represent the county in the larger competitions, then you get this big printed flash to put on the back of your tracksuit for the name of your county. And so that this is the sort of thing, you could have it on your tracksuit and then you'd wear it around the school for other sports. And so I had Kent written across my back. And because of course Kent has got very few letters in it, it's only four letters. So if you're born in Buckinghamshire, then of course the letters are very tiny. But if you're from Kent, it's like big sort of 6-inch high letters splayed across your back. So I was extremely proud of this. Unfortunately, they didn't. Kent didn't put forward a junior representation for the hurdles in the nationals. But then at the intermediate level, they did. So then, when I was, I guess, 14, then I went to the national competition, the kind of national trials for athletics. And so this was a huge deal for me, and I felt, you know, so proud, and this was a massively important thing. And of course, I was the sort of prize hurdler at the school I was at, and then I was the county champion. So I was really quite used to being like the number one, and really enjoyed this, especially sort of walking around with this big flash across my back saying, Kent. Then of course you go to the national championships and everyone's got their county across their back. And not only that, they got all kinds of badges across the front of their tracksuits as well, saying, you know, national record holder, you know, first prize last year in the national championships, and all these other awards and achievements, which I didn't have any of. And then, when it, and of course, for this national trials. I trained and trained and trained and got as good as I could possibly get for this. And then we had the first heats for this big national trial. Hundreds and hundreds of athletes gathered in London for this event. And I was completely thrashed in the first heat. So I came about fifth or sixth or second to last and was knocked out of the competition, just sort of, just like that, gone, finished. I was a complete nobody. And so that was again, rather like Kitisaro at the wrestling bout. I don't think he reflected on it at the time. And when that happened to me, I just felt, oh, I lost. How painful, how miserable. But later on, I could see how, because of the degree of inflation that I'd gathered and how sort of special and important I felt myself to be, I didn't realize, oh, well, I'm a big fish, I'm a real champ in an extremely small field. And then when you start looking beyond that tiny little field, you know, you're really nothing very special. Yeah, nothing terribly extraordinary or unusual. So when we consider this, you might think, well, what's this got to do with the spiritual life, or how does this match onto our training, our practices as monastics or as lay practitioners? But it's interesting how even within a monastery where we officially we've left behind all these kind of worldly attitudes, we've left behind competitiveness, we're no longer trying to contend against others, but still it's interesting how those urges and tendencies can still filter in, because it wasn't just hurdles that I was, you know, that I was involved in, but also other competitions, academic exams, and then different sports. I used to do also what's it called, tetrathlon, which is a combination of a half-mile run, swimming, 200-yard swim, pistol shooting, and cross-country jumping on horseback. I used to do those competitions as well, and was quite successful in that. So you have all these kind of conditioning for sports and academics and passing exams and getting degrees and getting marks, scoring points. And then you come into a monastery and you officially leave all that behind. But it's interesting how many of those similar urges of comparing, you know, who can sit the longest, or who can memorize the chanting easiest? Who's always forgetting the words in the chanting? You know, who's never got their robe straight? You know, who's always impeccably tidy? You know, who's always got splots of tomato puree down the front of their robe? And you know, who's never shaves their head quite properly and always leaves a few tufts here and there? Yeah. Who quotes the suttas perfectly, and who can hardly even recite Namutasa? Yeah. Okay. Now I know there's eight in the Eightfold Path. Now let's think. Yeah. Yeah. So we can find ourselves being competitive in the monastery without even realizing it. And again, this came to mind today because I was recollecting that actually Lumpur gave me a medal once in the early days at Chidhurst, because I was, I guess I was completely oblivious to the fact that I was trying to be the sort of the champion monk. Having, I guess, I couldn't get a big flash across my back saying, you know, Ubon, you know, or Chidhurst, you know. But I was still running on the same ethic, running in the same race, as it were. I had no idea I was doing that, but I'm sure Lumpur saw it, because and during that time I was probably about two or three reigns as a monk. I was still in my early 20s, 23, 24 years old, and super keen and trying to do everything right. So I was trying to memorize all the chanting and keep all the Dutanga practices, ascetic disciplines, following very sort of strict regimes of austerity, one kind or another, and trying to keep all the Vinaya rules with a great scrupulousness, trying to sit in meditation longer than anybody else, sit straighter than everybody else, be basically best at trying to be best at everything, trying to be super monk. And at the time, it just seemed like, well, that's taking all these things, these attributes of what a good monastic is, that you don't fall asleep while the Dhamma talk's going on, you stay awake, you don't shift around while you're in meditation, you sit still, you endure the pain, you don't just get up and leave when the earliest opportunity, you sit longer and longer and longer, you don't just find the easy way around, you always offer to do more work, you show up earlier than everybody else for the work, and you work longer than everybody else for the work scene, and so on and so on and so on. Those are good things, so therefore you do them. If you do them, then therefore you're a good monk, and that's a good thing. obeying the form, being obedient to the form, that's good, because being disobedient is bad, so you should obey. I hadn't really realized how much I'd got sort of swept up in that, this is good, so therefore more of it is better. And that taking this very sort of superficial approach to monastic training, and also just unconsciously trying to be better than everybody else, trying to be the sort of top performing monk. And then one day, Lumpur actually gave me, it was like a little medallion. It was a Buddha image but it was made like a medal, so it had a sort of rectangular bar at the top, and then a little sort of diamond-shaped head of the Buddha on a diamond-shaped lozenge, sort of hanging down from that. So it actually did look like a sort of military medal. And he said, "Here, Venerable, this is for you." I said, and I sort of received it. He said, "It's a medal." And I thought, "Oh, that's very nice. Lumpur recognizes how well I'm performing." So I was so clueless that I didn't actually see it. This teaching. This is a teaching, capital T. Do you get it? And I thought it was just a medal. "Oh, that's very nice. Lumpur recognizes I am actually the top monk. Maybe the flash with Chithurst across the back. Okay. Being the representative of the Chithurst team will come later on." But it wasn't until quite a while later, actually, embarrassingly enough, 2 or 3 years later, that really it was about 2 or 3 years later I realized, oh, that wasn't just a medal. that was a reflection. That was a teaching from the master trying to point out, it's not about sitting longer than everybody else, or sitting straighter than everybody else, or having all the right answers and witty comments to make during the questions and answer sessions or the discussions at the monastery. It's not about that. It's not about being obedient to the form. It's not about just taking the form and squishing yourself into it and adopting the moves and perfecting them so that you're just you've learnt the behaviors of monastic life, and so you can replicate the forms in an expert way. It's not about that. The forms are there. They are important. They're useful, but just being able to perform according to the structures is not it. It's not a performance, it's a practice. We're not trying to perform, make monastic life into a performance or a competition to see who can do the best, or who's the most impressive, or the wisest, or the most peaceful, or the most humble, competing to be the most humble. But it took a long time for me to see that, for that to sink in, because the habits were so strong. And so this is something to reflect upon, you know, here. And it's not just like, oh, well, that's just, you know, Ajahn Amaro back in the old days, ha, 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 you know. Well, you know, I certainly don't suffer from that, or, you know, that never happens here at Amaravati nowadays. You know. We're all way beyond that, aren't we? But still, isn't it the what happens to us day by day? We still compare ourselves to others, or compare others to ourselves, or judge this person as being better, or this person as being more helpful, or wiser, or kinder, or more compassionate, or is really committed. We do judge each other. We create these identities for ourselves, and we measure ourselves, we measure others according to these standards of compliance with a particular form, or I say the adherence to the sets of rituals and customs and traditions, it's not that there isn't such thing as beautiful conduct, or that there isn't such thing as sort of inappropriate or sloppy conduct. Yes, there are those things, but it's the quality of identification that makes the difference. It's the believing in those judgments, believing in those forms, and investing in them, and following these competitive urges or comparing urges, and making them into absolute identities, like, you know, just like forgetting that I was an American. Like, oh yeah, that's quite an interesting reflection. Oh yeah, I forgot that I have this other nationality. I got an American passport. That slipped my mind. Or like Lumpur recognizing, oh, that's interesting, I've become more British than American. I just fell off the list. Just to notice where our identifications lie, how we judge ourselves, how we judge each other as being, you know, worthy or noble or inspiring or beautiful. Over and over again, over the years, I would see, you know, in my own conditioning, I would be judging myself or judging others, and then Lumpur Sumedho would keep sabotaging those views, and he would make these kind of comments, and also speak in praise of someone, or be very supportive of someone who you felt was, you know, not really trying, or not really kind of with the program, someone who was not, say, being a good monastic, a good nun, or a good monk. And then over and over again, Lumpur Sumedho would make some sort of gesture of affirmation or a gesture of support or praising that person. And I'd feel as, oh, what? No, but they've got it all wrong, or they don't do that well, or that's not right, or how can he? But it was like holding up that kind of comment or that kind of reflection that Lumpur would give is so helpful to, you know, hold up a mirror to one's own habits of projection and judgment, and say, oh yeah, well, who says that my particular perspective or the judgments that I have about what's good and what's right and what's bad and what's wrong, who says that is anything absolute or real or important? So the element of identification, the element of becoming, that I feel is so important, how we take these aspects of our life, our body, our personality, our role in the society, our role in the community, things that we call successes and failures, the extent to which we make those into absolute realities and make them solid is the extent to which we create suffering for ourselves. That bhava tanha is the direct cause of dukkha. It's, you know, right there in these verses that we chant, dukkha samudaya, karmatanna bhavatanna vibhavatanna. And that it's difficult to see. It takes a bit of effort to see those areas where we do compare, we do prefer, we do judge. And the more that we can take a step back from that, the more that we can arouse the quality of caution around our own judgments, or like Lumpo Cha would encourage, just to remind yourself, it's not a sure thing, my Nair. You know, when the mind says, that's good, to recollect, it's not a sure thing. When the mind says, that's awful, that's wrong, to recollect, it's not a sure thing. It's not sure. It's uncertain. This is a relative judgment, a conditioned perspective. It's just your preferred picture. And that small amount of spaciousness around the way that we hold our judgments, our likes and dislikes, it makes an enormous difference. All the difference in the world, really. So letting go of becoming, letting go of that believing in our judgments, believing in our perceptions and thoughts, this is the direct path to peace. I like to quote this passage. It's a dialogue between Venerable Sariputta and Venerable Ananda, when Ananda is asking Sariputta about when the mind is completely let go of all identification with the senses. You say, if you're in a state of meditation and you've completely dropped the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, the mind, the thinking, and there's a complete letting go of the whole sense world, yeah, is there still is the mind still attending to something? What is it attending to? And Venerable Sariputta says, yes, it's still attending, it's still the mind is still very aware, and what it's aware of is bhava nirodha nibbanang. What the mind is aware of is nibbana is the cessation of becoming. Nibbana is the cessation of becoming. That's what the mind is aware of. So when there's a complete letting go, a dropping of that, adherence and attachment to the senses, then what remains is that realization, this is the cessation of becoming, this is peaceful. The heart is free of that identification, free of that tension, free of that clinging. This is peaceful. This is the real peace. And when we consider the cessation of becoming, bhava nirodha, nibbanang, when we talk about the cessation of becoming or ending of becoming, then a superficial reading of that, we hear that, we think, okay, that means we shouldn't do anything. We should sort of just disengage, we should get a passive, we shouldn't get involved in anything, we certainly shouldn't be competing with anybody. We shouldn't be trying to contend or create any kind engagement that causes us to conflict or rub up against or compare ourselves to anybody else, to get into a situation where there is that kind of involvement or comparison going on. That we can take the letting go of becoming as an urge towards passivity or becoming sort of disengaged and uninvolved and disconnected. But as I say over and over and over again, it's not what it's pointing to. The ending of becoming doesn't mean stopping in our tracks. It doesn't mean sealing our mouth up. It doesn't mean freezing our thoughts. It doesn't mean making our emotions numb. It's not a matter of nullifying our life or trying to wipe out experience, because that is just vibhava tanha, the desire to not feel, the desire to not be, the desire to neutralize. And that is just as much of a cause of suffering as the desire to be. These are a pair. So we can often mistake the idea of letting go of becoming as a different kind of annihilation. But it's not that. It's just a different way of relating to the quality of engagement, As I was mentioning in the meditation guidance this morning, how it's a lot to do with learning how to practice right effort, how to, say, train the heart and mind to act from the place of mindfulness and wisdom, to be guided and motivated by satipanya, mindfulness and wisdom, rather than self-centered urges. So this is a lot to do with recognizing those self-centered habits, the eye-making and mind-making habits, to see them, to know them, to recognize the feeling of their presence, their texture, and to let go of them, to relinquish them. And this is not easy to do because our conditioning is so strong towards me and mine and I. Living in the community, having our own particular role, where we sit in the line, you know, who goes first through the door, you know, how many buses, how many rains retreats we have, are we a layperson, are we a monastic, are we an anagarika, a novice? You know, we have a lot of rankings, a lot of ordering in the conventions of our life here, so that just as out in the world, there's all sorts of ways that we rank each other, like the, you know, who comes first, second, third, fourth, fifth in the race, or you know, who's where in the medal table. You know, we have a lot of systematization, a lot of ways that we kind of order things. So there can, it can seem to be that there's a lot that steers us towards identification, towards taking a position and being somebody. You know, I am a man, I am a monk, I am 33 vasas, this is my 34th vasa, so you know, that's, you know, who and what I am on a conventional level. So the challenge is to keep noticing where those rankings, those ways of ordering ourselves and seeing ourselves, noticing wherever they occur and recollecting. You know, that's only a convention, that's only a manner of speaking, that's only a form agreed upon by society, this particular human group. It's not anything absolutely real. Yeah, these things don't have any fundamental substance. But it also helps just to consider and to take into account that the strength of our conditioning, how much we're forced into being an individual, and how we're praised for being an individual when we are going through our school and the family life and the integration to society, over and over and over again, it's impressed upon us that we're an individual, we're a separate, independent person, and we act in that way. Some years ago, when I was living in the States, I came across a very interesting comment made by a Native American man who had grown up in the Iroquois tribe, and he was talking about competition and the ethic that they have within their tribal life, and he was saying how it's not as though they don't have competitions. It's certainly, you know, you have a long ancient tradition of foot races, particularly amongst the young males. You're running the foot race, and you certainly, when you have a race against the other guys and you really put everything into it, you want to win, and you know that the one who comes first is going to get all the cheers and the praise and it's going to impress the other members of the tribe. So you certainly put effort into it, but also he said it for us, when we're running. Also, if I run and I win the foot race, I realize it's not just me winning, it's not just me running, but with me are my parents, with me are my grandparents, with me is the corn that I ate that morning, with me is the buck whose skin I'm wearing. You know, there's this consciousness of all these other contributing elements. So the idea that me as an independent individual has won this race, and it's all down to me and mine. So that, you know, if you grow up in a tribal society, it's actually impossible to think that way. You can't really hold it, and it's just me, that this is like an unthinkable thought. It just has no meaning. So I feel that's a helpful reflection on anatta. Like we chanted the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta this evening. So this is a lot to do, very directly to do with how to deconstruct the habits of identification, seeing how the I and me and mine feeling, how they cluster around the body, around sensation, around perception, around thoughts and ideas, attitudes, emotions, moods, and how around consciousness itself. Over and over again in the sutta, it says, "You know, etang mama. You know, this is mine. Eso hamasmi. This I am. Eso meata. This is myself." You can't apply that. You can't genuinely hold that to be true in relationship to any of those aspects of body and mind. No he tang bante. No, you can't say that, Venerable Sir. No, it isn't true. You can't say this is mine. This is what I am. This is myself. It doesn't apply. It's not real. It's not true. So this sense of seeing how our life is a shared quality. It's a participatory event, that our bodies are the results of our parents coming together and their parents coming together, and so on and so forth, back through uncountable generations through the evolutionary tree. Our bodies are the results of all of the air that we've breathed, the water that we've drunk, the food that we've eaten, the dana that was offered today. You know, the people gathered together, to offer the amsu. We think of the meal offering as a separate world, a separate set of events, a separate reality to your life in the temple, life in the sala at the mealtime. That's the food, and it's up on the servery, and then we have our alms bowl, and then there's the eating. But what are these bodies except alms food bodies? All of us monastics, many of us who've been here 10, 20, 30 years, these bodies are entirely composed of alms food. This body is sat up on that servery or other serveries. This body has been brought in little pieces by thousands, hundreds and thousands of people in little pots and bags and sacks and delivered to various monasteries to be brought together to comprise this body. So that these bodies are not ours. They're not. They're not a single separate thing. But when we revision them in this way, then it changes the manner in which we hold a sense of identity. Also, the way that we hold each other, the way we look at each other. That we can't, say, form that sense of distinct individual separateness in the same way. It doesn't hold water. It doesn't stand up. It doesn't make sense. Just like the Buddha, when he's having the dialogue with the five companions, says, can you say this, when he says to them, okay, when in relationship to the body, in relationship to rupa, physical form, can you say this is mine? Can you say this I am? Can you say this is myself? No, he tang bante, no, you can't say that. It's not true, it's not real. So that's one way of learning to see how it's not a matter of not running or not engaging with others or not involving ourselves like this the Iroquois man. It wasn't as though that letting go of self meant not trying to do his best, not trying to sort of win the race and impress his friends. But he also recognizing, well, this isn't just me. This isn't just an I. This is a communal and a shared process. Another reflection that comes to mind in this respect is it's in a slightly different fashion, is that again, it's not to point out how it's not a matter of not making an effort or not engaging, not so giving our all to some project, some event, some effort, but it's a matter of making that effort from a place of selflessness. And those of you who are familiar with Joseph Campbell, who is a well-known philosopher and mythologist, writer, and very influential in Western thinking, in the sort of religious, psychological, mythological domain. One thing that's not very well known about him, along with being a mythologist and a psychologist and a very accomplished writer, is that when he was a university student, he was a world-class half-miler, so that he was like an Olympic standard runner. And I don't think he actually ever ran in the Olympics. He peaked at his skill as a runner sort of between two Olympics. So he was running his fastest times sort of in the sort of the year in the middle of between two Olympic Games. But he was certainly that kind of Olympic class, world class runner for the half mile. So that's 880 yards for the half mile race. What would be the 800 meters equivalent? And when he was, they did a series of interviews with him on American television with a fellow called Bill Moyers. And when he asked Joseph Campbell what was the most significant spiritual experience of his life, he said it was doing a foot race. That was his most powerful mystical experience. And in his books, he talks at great length about all sorts of different spiritual qualities, and has obviously had a great deal of insight. But he said the greatest experience of awakening and realization came during a race, and it was a half-mile relay. So it was four different runners, each running a half-mile. So it was like a two-mile-long race altogether. And it was his college, I think Princeton University he was at, I believe, and racing against some other universities. And he was the anchor man. He was like the last runner to go in this relay. So the other three runners had gone before him. And I guess, if I'm remembering it correctly, it was just one other university they were running against, because I remember the story was he was just chasing one other runner. And that when he got the baton passed to him, the runner from the other team was about 40 or 50 yards ahead of him. So he was way behind. But he said his mind was in a very, very focused and concentrated state as he'd been watching the race progressing. And then when he received the baton, when that was put into his hand, something in him knew, this is my race. I'm going to win. I know I'm going to win this race. And he, as he started running, he said his mind went into this extraordinarily clear and concentrated state. And so even though he was running at full steam, running the race of his life, the internal experience was one of extraordinary stillness and clarity and peacefulness. There was an extraordinary, a vast inner silence that he was running in, even as his body is sort of hurtling along around this track, an American racetrack. And so that sustained itself throughout the whole of the half mile long race. And sure enough, when he came around to the final stretch, then he did in fact pass the other runner and win the race. So his intuition was right at the beginning. But he said that was the most profound spiritual experience of his life. So this sort of very reflective, wise person, very experienced, knowledgeable person, and also quite a mature spiritual practitioner as well, saying that the most important or powerful spiritual experience of his life was on a racetrack, running a race, competing. So even though his body was competing and his legs and his feet were running the race of their life, internally he was completely still and at peace. So you can interpret this however you like. I'm not saying Joseph Campbell's an arahant. But at that moment, then his mind by the way he describes the experience, his mind had come into a very clear and pure alignment with reality, with Dhamma. And so there was this great quality of peacefulness, but there was this extraordinary flow and the sense of the commitment to the race and doing what was necessary to run as well as he could. But there was no sense of tension within him. There was no fear, no anxiety. It was, he said, it was extraordinarily peaceful, but there was this commitment to the race happening simultaneously. So I felt that was in some respects, is a very good example of how we can apply all the effort necessary to even excel ourselves, go beyond our normal limits, and do the very best we can, living our life in following the meditation, engaging in the various types of work and community practices that we do living here, and those of you who are visitors and guests in your own domains, that we can be fully and heartfully engaged and exceeding our own expectations, exceeding what we think of as our own limits, and yet not be caught into the becoming process, not be caught into that me and mine, me trying to be someone, me trying to get somewhere, me trying to get something, me trying to be somebody. We can still excel, we can fulfill our potential to the highest degree without it being a burden to ourselves or to people around us. And this is a potential that we all have, and that in many respects, learning how to apply right effort, learning how to see that array of different self-centered qualities, how they have the habit to arise over and over again, to see that, to know that, and to train the heart to let go when we see that, to abandon it, to relinquish it, and then to taste the delight, the peacefulness and the genuine richness, the beauty of the heart free from that becoming, free from those self-centered habits, free from that kind of clinging. We have this potential, we have this possibility. And so when we bring that to fruition, when we bring that about, then we can see, know for ourselves, this is the bhava nirodha, this is the peace that comes from the ending of becoming, this is the peace that comes from a complete letting go, this is the peace of nibbana. So I offer these thoughts for consideration this evening.
Andamayang dhamma avadakata sadhu karanda dhamma se sadhu.